You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong toki ngua. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia mārunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā rua te kumarima o whiringa a rangi. Kia ora, you are listening to 95BFM and this is the Thursday Wire and I'm Justin Wong. E whai akine, coming up on the show today, we have our weekly chat with Health Minister Andrew Little and Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis on Neighbourhood Watch. Turmoil at the National Party again as leader Judith Collins demoted former leader Simon Bridges last night and stripped him of his portfolios while the party is in an emergency caucus meeting right now. As usual, he aha ofakaro, let me know what you think. Tukupatuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or why mai rane, give me a call on 309-3879. Let me know what you are doing now that the hairdressers are opening, or if you are a hairdresser, do call in to tell me how things are going, or if you have any your weirdest lockdown haircuts, or let me know what you think about the National Party leadership right now, considering everything's going through muck. Kawa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki eni kōrero anohi pakihere rokiroki mārunga I te paitukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. As always, you can catch all these stories and more by podcasts on the 95BFM website. I tēnā wā tonu. Now let's head over to Wellington.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about oximeters used in home isolation and the effects that vaccine mandates have on the health system's workforce numbers. But I began by asking him about his thoughts on the current crisis at the National Party.
I don't really have any comment to make about it. These are matters for the National Party and they just have to sort that out themselves.
Okay, but on moving on to the vaccine mandate now, well, the mandate for the health system have been kicked in for a week or so already. So how many people have left the public health system since the mandate started?
Look, I don't have the precise figures. It's reasonably small numbers at each DHB. And in fact, for many of them, many people have been kind of stood down. They haven't resigned or they haven't been dismissed. Some are waiting for the AstraZeneca vaccine to be available, which is now in the country and will be available from the end of this week. Others are considering whether they wish to have the vaccine or not. Some are awaiting exemption applications to come through. So, look, there are small numbers at each hospital that the people who are no longer available for work and hospitals are working around that.
Which DHB has the most staff that have been stood down? Do you know about that?
I couldn't tell you the one that has the most staff stood down. Obviously, it varies from one DHB to the next. But in terms of the total workforce, it is comparatively small numbers.
So it won't be affecting any patient safety?
It certainly won't be affecting patient safety. It may cause some minor disruption to staff who are continuing to work if their shifts aren't fully staffed, but I imagine that those issues will be resolved reasonably swiftly regardless of what happens.
So all the staff that have been stood down, none of them are responsible for direct COVID care?
Not as far as I know, no. Like, there's a range of sort of positions that are affected, nurses, some doctors, some non-frontline health staff as well. So a range of people who just in the position where they either haven't got vaccinated or don't wish to, or are waiting for some suitable alternative.
Well, when you say some nurses have been stood down, considering there's quite a lot of vacancies for nurses as well, do you think they will just put on more pressure on the existing workforce?
Yeah, well, it's certainly not helping, because you're right, there's a large number of vacancies across the nursing workforce across the country. So this won't help. But hospitals typically get those vacancies covered by agency nurses and others doing a bit of extra overtime. It's not a good long-term solution, but that's the way it's covered at the moment. But if you're asking, is my preference that no one had to be stood down, absolutely it is. But this is the situation that we're in, and people are making the choices that they're entitled to make in relation to vaccination.
Well, earlier you announced that 300 healthcare workers will be let into MIQ every month. How many have been let in so far?
As I understand it, for this month, or because that was effectively started this week, and it is, I think there's about 125 who are taking up positions or places in MIQ this week and next week.
Where will they go after they come out of MIQ?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's a range of nurses, doctors, some working for private GP clinics and things like that. So, a range of people from doing different jobs once they complete their isolation.
Okay. Moving to my second topic of the day, I want to talk about oximeter uses in home isolation. So only around 900, how many people in home isolation have oximeters? Because not everyone has them, right?
No, and it was never intended that everybody has them. So I think of roughly 1,500 or 1,600 people isolating at home who are infected with COVID, there's about 1,100 or 1,200 who have pulse oximeters. But before the pulse oximeters are distributed, there's a bit of an assessment done about whether the person needs it. If you're younger and you don't have any other kind of health issues and the only thing you have is COVID and your symptoms are mild, then you're probably not going to need a pulse oximeter. If you're older and you've got other health issues going on, or if your symptoms are slightly more serious but still not requiring hospital level care, then you might get a pulse oximeter just to keep track of your blood oxygen level and your pulse. But it was never intended that everybody who is infected with COVID gets a pulse oximeter, because some people simply won't need it.
Some health experts say more information should be given to those who are using those pulse oximeters at home on teaching them how to use it. Do you think this has been done enough so far?
Yeah, I've certainly seen some situations where people say they don't quite understand how to use it. I think at the time the pulse oximeter is provided, and it's usually dropped off as part of a package, there are instructions on how to use it, on what it's for and how to use it. There's also access to an 0800 number if you're a little bit unsure about how to use it and what it's for, and you can get advice over the phone. There are some situations where I think, and we'll probably see more of this, where the pulse oximeters as well as other care material are dropped off by a person or in person, and there's the possibility, even if standing at a distance, for some more kind of physical instruction given on how to use the pulse oximeter and how to read it.
Okay, there's a recent study in the UK that found that oximeters can overstate the amount of oxygen in people with darker skin, and your counterpart in London, Sajid Javid, has ordered a review into whether the devices are equally effective for patients regardless of ethnicities. Do you think New Zealand should have a similar review on that?
Yeah, I know the Minister, I've asked the Minister of Health about that, and they said, look, they've looked at kind of peer-reviewed articles. They say, look, it's inconclusive. If you have a look at the most recent outbreak, where those being infected with COVID are predominantly Māori and Pacific, and therefore of the pulse oximeters going around, they are predominantly going to Māori and Pacific people, and there's been no reported concern about the measurements and the readings being taken from the pulse oximeters haven't gone to those people. But to your earlier point, some have been a bit confused about how to use them correctly, but those who are using them are not reporting there's anything wrong with the readings that they're getting.
Well, my final question for today is, well, after the borders open, would the home isolation still be in place for COVID-positive cases?
Oh, yes. In fact, once the borders are open, and people will have free movement around the country. Look, COVID is going to turn up around the country. There will be more people infected with COVID. The benefit of being vaccinated, however, is that if you do get infected with COVID, you're much less likely to get the more serious symptoms and much less likely, therefore, to have to go to hospital. So most people will be able to isolate at home. We're just going to make sure that people get the right care and the right clinical oversight while we're at home.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te waia tini marunga irirangi poho. That was Health Minister Andrew Little, and you are listening to The Thursday Wire on 95BFM. Give me a call on anything you want to talk to. The number is 309-3879, or you can text me on 5395. It's 13 past midday here in Auckland. We will be back after a break.
Whether you need gifts for family and friends, delicious food to fill out Christmas lunch, or add a table centrepiece, you'll find everything you need for a fantastic festive season at Scarecrow. Part of the Sustainable Business Network, the majority of Scarecrow stock is New Zealand made, so you can feel good about what you're buying. Scarecrow, kitchen, florist, grocer. Open 7 days a week in two locations, Victoria Street East by Albert Park and 811 Mount Eden Road. Or shop online at scarecrow.co.nz.
Fresh off the back of their new album and a sold-out US tour, British rock band Idols are heading back to New Zealand for the first time since their sold-out 2019 tour. Idols, performing live at the Auckland Town Hall, Saturday 29 October. Tickets are on sale now. Go to livenation.co.nz.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, I'm looking for a flatmate in the loom that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticate, wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide. Every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
What a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Now, National is still locked in an emergency caucus meeting with speculations of a leadership challenge after a chaotic Wednesday night, which saw leader Judith Collins demote former leader Simon Bridges and stripping all of his portfolios. Collins sent out a press release at 9 p.m. last night saying the National Party's board unanimously agreed to strip Bridges of all his shadow portfolios after he was accused of making crude comments to a female caucus colleague. It was later confirmed the colleague in question was Waitaki MP Jackie Dean, and the alleged comments were made 5 years ago in a caucus event in Wellington. Collins was supposed to front a press conference with her deputy, Dr. Shane Retty, as well as Jackie Dean at 10 a.m, but it was still put on hold. It was understood that Dean made a complaint to National's then leader, Bill English, and Simon Bridges apologised personally. Judith Collins said in her statement on Wednesday night she was only made aware of the seriousness of the complaint for the first time and the ongoing distress it caused to the complaint, and she was left no option but to immediately demote Bridges and strip him of his portfolios. Simon Bridges, who has been long rumoured to challenge Collins for the National Party leadership, told reporters in Parliament this morning that what happened yesterday was, quote, desperate stuff from Collins to hold onto the position.
What we saw yesterday was truly desperate stuff from Judith Collins. I think it shows actually that she'll go to any length to hold on to the leadership of the National Party. There's a huge amount I want to say about what happened yesterday and how wrong it was, and I assure you I will, but I want to talk to my caucus first and be very clear with them about what I think and what I think should happen for the National Party. But I assure you, I will do a full press conference after that as soon as possible.
Tamaki MP Simon O'Connor, who is also Simon Bridges' brother-in-law, has said Judith Collins must resign and he would be returning all his portfolios. Right now, stuff has just reported National MPs have expressed their displeasure with Collins, with one member saying she would resign by the end of the day if Collins was still leader, and another saying Collins had gone too far. Auckland University's Dr. Lara Greaves is joining us now to talk about what this means for the party now. Kia ora, Lara.
Kia ora.
So, well, mess is the least you can say about what the position that National is in.
Yeah, it's a very, I guess, bad position for everyone in society generally, because they're meant to be the opposition. And at the moment, they're doing infighting and figuring out who their leader's going to be. So I think they are in a bit of a mess, because in pandemic, what we want is we want assured leadership, we want united leadership and like a strong team, to use National's own words. So I think fundamentally, we lose out in terms of a democracy not having that strong opposition, but also National do need to figure out some way to get it together for 2023.
Okay, just in breaking news, it has been reported that Judith Collins has been ousted as leader of the National Party. And but on back on the my previous question, though, that having infighting in the opposition means it will take pressure off the government, right? Considering they have been kind of back-to-back under the pressure on issues related to COVID.
Yeah, and so I'm not surprised that Judith Collins has been rolled as leader, given that this caucus meeting has gone on that long. I suspect that they are going to a leadership and deputy leadership vote, and that is why we've been waiting for hours with the RNZ thing open and watching all the reporters come and go. But ultimately, I think that what it comes down to is, in New Zealand we have an MMP electoral system, and you can see sort of obviously the Greens and Labour on the left and National and ACT on the right, and you can see that potentially, if we're looking at it, maybe it might be an early election. I mean, there's precedent for Ardern to call an election for mid-2023 or maybe potentially later 2023. In the time between now, then, like where we are now and where the polls are now and then, we have to see that right block come up a little bit more in order for them to be competitive. Now, it's also not clear what's going to happen in terms of any potential centrist party or any other party, what the Māori Party would do in coalition agreements. I think fundamentally, though, is that as it sits now, you'd have to be really silly to bet against the left-wing government in 2023.
And look, well, now Collins has been rolled. If Simon Bridges becomes leader again, do you think it will do much to improve National standing, considering that David Seymour and the ACT Party is taking quite a lot of the voting share?
I think there are some issues there for Simon Bridges. So we know there was the earlier Jamie Lee Ross scandal, and there was that phone recording of him offending migrant communities, and then, of course, calling Maureen Pugh effing useless. And then we're also seeing now potentially comments, and we'll see more of the allegations quite soon. I imagine they'll come out over the next couple of days, of exactly what he said, and that potentially offending women. And women are a really key voting bloc to be able to hold, especially since they, at the moment, from what we can see from 2020, women moved to Labour. So he needs to figure out how to get those key voting blocks for National back. And then I guess this is also part of his broader narrative. He's got this renewal or regeneration narrative. So we saw him resign after the negative Facebook post that was a press release. We saw him lose out then. And then now he's kind of gone through this process of renewal. We all saw him with his long haircut with the baby yak and kind of him seeming a bit more folksy. And we saw his book as well, which was, again, more relatable. And we've seen him sort of become someone who is a lot more relaxed in the public eye, who's not trying to be someone who he's not. So he has had this hopeful journey over the last few years in the public eye, from being that sort of unliked leader to being perhaps more relatable. It's not clear right now whether that's just in the Twitter sphere or the commentator sphere or the media sphere, or whether the general public actually like him again. Mm-hmm. So that's still, I guess, a challenge for him, is going to be that likability and really also now trying to unite the party. So we see lots of different sort of people that are united in that broad church of National. So they traditionally represent the farmers, they represent business interests, they represent more social conservatives, they represent urban liberals. So it's a really key challenge for whoever does take that leadership, and if it's Bridges, to be able to unite all of those different factions and all of those different types of voters.
Well, that's all talk of party unity, though. Is there going to be a chance that there could be much of the voter base remained loyal to Judith Collins and maybe even split out from the National Party, like what Alfred Ngaro, former National MP, said he would do, I think, last election?
I think the socially conservative and or religious Christian voting bloc is a really interesting one to keep an eye on here, because ultimately that's not who the Act set out to represent. They're more in that, back to their libertarian roots potentially being a bit more populist now. So I think that's a really interesting group to watch going forward. If we have someone like, so Simon Bridges has talked about his religion in the past, Shane Retty is from a Mormon background, and Christopher Luxon has talked about his religion as well. So we've got those potential leaders, or the people that we could see as leaders after today's spill, that do have that more religious background, or those understanding of religious communities. So I think that the potential leaders will be more able to reunite that voter bloc in behind National. However, if it was someone like Chris Bishop or Nicola Willis who comes out of that room as leader, then that will be a different dynamic again. And I do fundamentally think that one of the great things for National would be if a religious party did split off, because then they would be able to speak to that broader centre-right position. But then those voters who prioritise their religion in their policy positions would be able to feel represented, and they'd have that party there. So I think that would be a gift to National, but it's not clear whether, it's really not clear what's going to happen in these next couple of years.
And interesting that you brought back leadership. Now there's also considerations, like you said, a combination of Chris Bishop, Nicola Willis, or maybe even the dark horse, Chris Luxon. How important is a stable leadership to a political party?
I think that stable leadership is incredibly important. Obviously, the counterfactual of that was Labour just suddenly putting Ardern in as leader a couple of months before the 2017 election. But we still have to remember that that 2017 election, National got a greater vote share than Labour. So fundamentally, these leadership changes don't look good. They don't, especially don't look good in a time of crisis or the pandemic, where people do want to know that the country is in a safe pair of hands, that a strong team is leading the government. So ultimately, I think that the timing of this leadership change is really good for the next election, because you don't want to be changing leaders in the year before the election, as we saw with National last year. So having that strong leadership team is going to be really important. And then now for whoever the new leader is, for them to do a bit of a tour of New Zealand. I see from David Seymour's Instagram, he's out there like meeting people out in the electorate today. So to really kind of do that sort of thing where you're out there in the public and you know, they're shaking hands and kissing babies, although you wouldn't kiss babies or shake hands with a pandemic. But getting out there and really telling us who they are. So say it does end up being Christopher Luxon. We need to know who he is, like his background, like how he reacts to things, and really get out there and really it being a good at least sort of a good year and a half before we hit that election period. That gives whoever the leader is a really good opportunity to build that public identity.
Yeah, speaking of the news, News Hub is just reporting that Christopher Luxon is the new leader of the National Party. Do you think, well, having a Luxon leadership, is he too young to be, or too early in his parliamentary career to be in the role? Because there were a lot of comparisons between him and John Key.
Yeah, and it's not clear that that's what the public still want. So I think that that's going to be a really interesting challenge there, is that the public still wants that kind of figure. However, one of the big vulnerabilities for Labour going forward is that the public always use National and always use the right as owning the economy, as owning that issue. So the real key challenge for Labour with Christopher Luxon as leader is undermining his ability to do the books, his ability to sort of steer us through what the public may perceive as an economic crisis. When we look at the polling data from Talbot Mills, who are formerly UMR, who wrote a chapter for Stephen Levine's book on the election, we actually see a good chunk of people still believing that National would have been, despite all the issues, still would have been the strongest candidate to lead National and the country through the pandemic. So I think the real challenge here now is for Luxon to really own that economic, that business leader type role, and get out there, elbow bump people, blow kisses at baby, whatever pandemic behaviour is good, and have the public get to know him and really see who he is as a person and what it is that drives him. And that's his challenge now, is introducing Luxon.
But what next for Simon Bridges and Judith Collins, though? Because there's a space of there that few people really talk about, is what to do with former opposition leaders or political party leaders.
Well, I think for Judith Collins, she is in her, I think about early, like about around 62-ish in age. So she's kind of headed, I guess, to the end of, well, around when people would normally retire. I imagine she could go off and sit on various boards and take a few other sort of leadership kind of things relating to law or business. But for Bridges, he is a bit younger. He is in his 40s still. And so it's not clear whether he will stick around or what he will go off to do. It is really awkward to be in that position. We also have to see what these allegations are in full as well, because it might be just best for him to move on at this point with whatever these allegations are of sexual harassment type behaviour.
Okay, thanks for joining us. And that was Dr. Lara Greaves from the University of Auckland. And if you have just missed the latest news, Judith Collins has been ousted as the leader of the National Party, and News Hub is now reporting that Christopher Luxon, the MP for Botany, is now the new leader of the opposition and the leader of the National Party. We will be back after another break, and here's some pigeon for you.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And while I was speaking with Dr. Lara Greaves from Auckland University about the prospects of Labour, of the National Party leadership, there have been reports that Judith Collins has been ousted as the leader of the National Party. Just want to clarify on that. Judith Collins has indeed been reported to be ousted from the National Party leadership, and now Dr. Shane Drety is the interim leader and with no deputy for now. It has been reported in other outlets, including RNZ, that a leadership decision will be taken next week, and it was reportedly between Christopher Luxon and Mark Mitchell. As I might repeat once again, Judith Collins has indeed been reportedly ousted as National leader, and a decision will be on a new leader will be taken next place between reportedly between Mark Mitchell and Christopher Luxon. And now let's head over to Australia first.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has introduced a controversial religious discrimination bill at the Federal Parliament in Canberra. But I first began with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes on the latest COVID-19 situation in South Australia.
So South Australia have opened their borders Tuesday night to interstate travellers who are double vaccinated. It's really exciting. There's been some really happy scenes taking place at Adelaide Airport with families being reunited, and the borders, the Victorian and South Australia border particularly, just had so many cars travelling over it, and it's a really exciting, happy time for so many people and so many families who, you know, some that might not have even been able to see each other since before COVID. So, you know, it's really exciting. But then there's also the flip side, of course, as there's always going to be, and how there was always somewhat expected to be. Yesterday it was announced that South Australia had its first official COVID-19 case since opening the borders. So the case was a young girl from Dahoria who was travelled into the state. She came by car, so by road, and she was with her family and relatives. So essentially, yeah, she travelled into the state with her family and she only made one stop, I think, at a petrol station, and then they went back to their home and she found out she had COVID and she went back to Victoria. So it has caused a little bit of frustration and confusion amongst some South Australians. Obviously people are a bit like, why do we have to open the borders, you know, South Australia? Through all this process, you know, we've only really had the initial lockdowns as the whole world had. And then we only really had 1 week. And I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm telling this to you, Justin. So he's in their 100th day of lockdown, so I am sorry. But, you know, there has been a lot of confusion amongst the community with the borders opening. So it's a really interesting time. It's like good times and also bad times.
Okay, but before the borders, the interstate borders were lifted, what's the rate of vaccination in SA?
So we are at 79% of the population over the age of 15 have been fully vaccinated. And I think we are over 85% of the population have their first dose. Yeah, we're 79% fully vaccinated, so we're almost at 80%. And I think we're striving for that 85%, 90% goal.
And before the border was lifted, was South Australia COVID-free for a while, apart from the 1 week lockdown that you had, I think, before our current outbreak started?
We were pretty COVID-free. We still had a lot of restrictions in place. Masks were mandatory and, capacity restrictions and sitting down, no standing and drinking. And actually, South Australia is notoriously the only state to not allow dancing yet. So you can dance at a private function with under 100 people, but you can't, like, dance in, you know, clubs or when you're out and about. So, yeah, we are a bit of a footloose state at the moment.
Are they, apart from the clubs, that only, you know, restricts to only 100 people, are there any other restrictions in place?
Yeah, there's capacity restrictions. We are starting to see a lot of those lifted. There's no home restrictions. So, you know, it's nothing really, especially compared to places that are actually in lockdown. But, I think masks is the main one. Masks are very common in South Australia, despite us not really having any cases. But now that the borders have opened, obviously, you know, we have to be way more responsible. And we are probably going to see more cases. Probably next week, you know, I'm going to be saying way more, and, you know, restrictions might be a little bit more heavy. But our Premier has said that there's going to be no more lockdowns, essentially. So we can't expect to be in lockdown again.
Okay, that's kind of like a lot similar to our situation here when we move into the traffic light system. Okay, but moving on to something non-COVID, there is a controversial religious discrimination bill that has been put through in the federal parliament. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this bill is the Prime Minister's, Scott Morrison's, really long-awaited religious discrimination bill. It's finally been released, and it's outlining how the federal government sort of intends to enshrine greater protection of people of faith. This bill was a real election sort of promise and commitment back in 2019, and it was born. Unfortunately, it was born out of the debate over the legislation of same-sex marriage in 2017. So the controversial laws have been obviously subject from there to some really intense debate during the consultation period, and on whether, you know, extra religious protections can be legislated without, you know, discriminating against the rights of others. So there's been a lot of input from several faith leaders into this bill. But obviously the legislation still really continues to evoke concerns from the LGBTIQ plus community. And the bill sort of states that the intention of the law is to eliminate, quote, so far as is possible, quote, discrimination against people on the grounds of their religious beliefs. So that one liner obviously sounds really positive. We don't want to be discriminating against people for their religious beliefs. But if you think about the sort of history behind this bill, it's been created by Scott Morrison, and it was born, as I said, out of the same-sex marriage, the equal marriage debate that we had to sort of endure during 2017, and which eventually went down to a vote. I can't remember the word, what it's called now. It definitely doesn't feel right, and there's a lot of contention surrounding referendum. That was the word I was trying to think of.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper!
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis. Now, before we head off our finish our show and just trying to sum up what has been a madness of around a half and 30 minutes, producer Joe Wickens brings us a report about a new research article on anxiety.
Earlier this week, a Kiwi recipient received a L'Oreal UNESCO for Women in Science Fellowship. The neuroscientist from the University of Otago was awarded for her research surrounding how we perceive anxiety and mental health. Her studies look at understanding how others perceive symptoms of anxiety, such as fast heart rate, a shortness of breath, and sweaty palms, and how one's response to this could influence another's mental state. Her research brings attention to the struggles of 1 in 4 New Zealanders Her research shows that currently we are seeing anxiety occur at a more disabling level, and our coping strategies and treatments are lagging behind. I reached out to the neuroscientist about her work. Unfortunately, she was unavailable for an interview. However, next week, I will be sure to follow up.
This, you're listening to 95 BFM. We will be back after another break.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95 BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
You're listening to Totally Wired, the all-new music show. My name is Jess Fu.
Thanks for stopping by for the 95 BFM Kids Show.
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection.
So this is one for the musical theatre nerds out there.
Welcome along to Thursday Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry.
And we will let you know about Drive Island, of course.
Never miss out again. Becast, available on Apple Podcasts. Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. 5 different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hop Butcher, New Leaf's trademark non-alcoholic beer brewed with kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Door sales only during level 3. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The Wire.
You're listening to 95BFM and this is the Thursday Wire with Justin Wong. In case you have missed this news coming in the last half hour, Judith Collins is no longer the leader of the New Zealand National Party. In the last 5 minutes, Ms. Collins tweeted a statement saying, quote, "I am pleased to say that I am just the MP for Papakura again. It's been a privilege to take over the leadership of the New Zealand National Party during the worst of times and to do so for 16 months. It has taken huge stamina and resolve and has been particularly difficult because of a variety of factors. I knew when I was confided in by a female colleague regarding her allegation of serious misconduct against a senior colleague that I would likely lose the leadership by taking the matter so seriously. If I hadn't, then I felt that I wouldn't deserve the role. I didn't ask for the allegation to be given to me. I am proud of the support I received from Dr. Shane Reti, a man of principle, and I will continue to advocate not only for Papakura, but for those who have no voice. A big thank you to the wonderful staff in the National Leader's Office, my Papakura office, National Party members, and my wonderful colleagues. I'm so pleased that I can spend more time with my family and friends, and I will not miss the grueling media schedule." After Judith Collins is ousted, Dr. Shane Reti is now the interim leader until caucus meets next Tuesday to choose a new leader, reportedly between Mark Mitchell and Christopher Luxon.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire today. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero me ki a mātou mo tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Dr. Lara Greaves, Health Minister Andrew Little, and Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi pōho. You're still tuning into 95BFM. Johnny and Big Hungry will be here for Drive at 4, but now Sigrid is now taking over for the 1-2-4. Enjoy the rest of the day. Take a breather. Digest the news that New Zealand will have another new national leader. And get a haircut if you can. See you next week. Mā te wā. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.